We here at Murder Road are in quarantine, just like all the rest of you. Everyone is under incredible stress, and we just want you to know that we're with you, and we hope all the best for our listeners during this crisis. Please reach out for help if you are unable to cope with the stress. If you are feeling even remotely suicidal, please don't be ashamed to get help. You can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Stay home, use social distancing, wash your hands, and stay safe. Thanks for listening. Murder Row discusses themes of homicide, violence, sexual assault, and at times uses explicit language. Listener discretion is highly recommended.
My name is Liz, and I grew up on Murder Road. That's not the actual name of the road, that's just how people called it when I needed a ride home. "It's dark, and I'm scared of Murder Road," was a standard response when I'd ask people if they could drop me off at home. I feel really compelled to do this because I've spent my entire life wondering how these murdered people got there, who they were, and what happened to them. It's been 26 years we're talking about here, and we still don't have any answers. All we have are dead bodies. Welcome to Murder Road Podcast. My best friends are here helping me, and they are...
I'm Katie. Hi.
I'm Misty. Hi.
So with us tonight is our very special guest, Paula, from the Ohio Mysteries Podcast. She's our armchair journalist.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Would you be able to tell the listeners about Ohio Mysteries a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So my nephew called me when he found out I was going to be retiring about a year and a half ago and asked me if I wanted to use my retirement doing a podcast with him. So we kind of tossed out ideas of what we might do. And we settled on the mysteries in Ohio, really diverse. And they could be unsolved murders. They could be disappearances. But they could be missing shipwrecks. They could be buried treasure. They could be Bigfoot or UFOs. And so we've done over 100 episodes. We release 2 episodes a week. And it's kind of just sort of a storytelling. We don't do a lot of the heavy first-person research like you guys are doing. It's really, we do the low-hanging fruit, what kind of research is out there that we can find, and then we tell you a story about that particular mystery.
Where can people find Ohio Mysteries?
Well, if you have a podcast, which I hope if you're listening to this, you do know, just search for Ohio Mysteries. And we also have a website, ohiomysteries.com, with direct links to all of our episodes.
Okay, awesome. One of the things I like about your show so much is the musical guest.
I'm glad you love that.
The Ohio musical artist. That's one of my favorite parts.
Mine too. Well, we have a tab on our website where we list all of the bands we've used. We link to the YouTube version of the songs that we used. And we have a Spotify playlist button. And if you click on that, it's a jukebox of every song that we've used.
Oh, that's awesome.
That is so rad. Yeah.
Do bands contact you for that? Or do you kind of hand select the stuff that you found that you like?
Very few bands have contacted us. I wish they would more. Go to ohiomysteries.com, find the contact link, let us know. We're just looking for musicians from Ohio making original music. And yeah, most of the time I have to go in and just search for bands in Ohio, and I find lists, and then I have to find their contact information and listen to their music. I would love for them to come find us. It would be a lot less work. But
similarly, where do you guys find your armchair detectives? I know how we found you, but I don't know how you generally find armchair detectives.
Most of our armchair detectives are our listeners. So every once in a while, I will put out a call and say, does anybody want to be an armchair detective? I got to tell you, we don't vet them. I have no idea what to expect.
Us either.
When these people call. We think of Ohio Mysteries as a community.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, even if you don't have a whole lot to say, but you really want to feel part of the community, you know, the armchair detectives at the end. But some of our armchair detectives have called people and done interviews. They've walked the crime scene. They've gone to libraries. And they've come up with information we didn't have.
It's amazing.
And sometimes they come up with a theory that I haven't heard that I am super impressed with.
That's awesome.
And I feel like you need to call the police. You know, yeah. Make sure they looked at this idea.
But do people know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's weird because I feel like your guys' podcast is so good. And the way you present the information is so concise and so palatable that I feel like you guys have a national appeal, not just an Ohio appeal.
You are too kind.
No, I really do. I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts. So
I've had somebody say, your podcast is really amateur. And I said, We are amateurs.
Yeah.
Steve had to teach himself how to edit. I've been in print journalism. I've never had to speak publicly. I said, we are amateurs. So I don't feel bad. It's very casual. It's not polished, but we're okay. That's our niche. And so what you're saying makes me feel really good. Thank you.
Well, you guys really are the best. I love your voice. And so every time I hear your guys' new episode, I'm excited. I'm like, oh, look, it's my friend Paula. That's what we want you to think.
Yeah. We want you to see us as your friends. We really want that community, you know.
Yeah.
Come hear the band we have at our little party tonight and listen to this friend of yours that we pulled out of our, you know, listener list to be the armchair.
I think people hear, like, podcasts and think that somehow we're not just regular people just doing a thing. And there's, like, a sense of, like, because America, we have this really unhealthy relationship with celebrity.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's like any minuscule sense of celebrity people get, it just puts a wall between you and them. And I feel like you guys do a good job of bridging that gap.
I appreciate that.
So let's talk about your background in print journalism, if you don't mind. How did you get started? How long have you been working in print journalism?
When I was in eighth grade, the nun at my school made us all write down what we wanted to be when we grew up, and I wrote down journalist. Mm-hmm. And so it was eighth grade. It was just kind of ingrained in me then. When I went to high school, I was a sports reporter for the high school newspaper, mm-hmm. and I really kind of thought sports journalism was going to be my thing. So I went to Kent State, and the first year I covered, you know, wrestling and wheelchair basketball and some of these sports that, you know, the more veteran staffers were doing. Yeah, you got it. And then one class assigned me to cover the graduate school for that semester. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a big controversy in the graduate school, and I had to interview the president of the university. And then there was a, you know, this spat between him and me over what I was covering, and it was like stressful. And when I was done with that, I was like, covering sports is the most boring thing ever. You know, I want to cover this kind of stuff because it really had meaning. I mean, there were people whose, you know, livelihoods and lifestyles were being affected by some decisions that were being made, and they were counting on me to provide the information. And right then I thought, I'm not going to be a sports journalist. I want to cover really meaningful, not that sports have their place. I love sports, but just in terms of affecting your daily life, mm-hmm. I wanted to do that kind of journalism. So I graduated from Kent in 1982. I did a lot of freelance work. I used to write cover trials for the UPI, United Press International.
Nice.
And then corresponded for the Akron Beacon Journal until I turned 30. They offered me a job. I figured, well, I guess I better. So they hired me, and I worked there for, I don't know, including the years that I was a correspondent for them, almost 30 years.
Oh, wow, that's great. Were you with them during 93 and 94 when everything happened at Berlin Lake?
I was. I was hired in 1991, so I was full-time.
Were you responsible for covering or doing any of the research for these cases?
No. The most I did was every once in a while we would do a story about cold cases, and then we would just touch on cases that were out there. Mm-hmm. And I remember Lisa Waters and Andy Hussey and Catherine Menendez making those lists.
Right. Do you remember that coming through the newsroom?
I remember.
When it initially happened?
I do. I mean, I can't set the scene for you, like where I was the day it happened.
Right.
But I do remember when the Waters and Hussey case was new and being covered.
Yeah. Were there any theories jumping around the newsroom? Do you remember if there was any kind of like big buzz about it? Or was it a hot topic of conversation or anything?
I wish I could tell you I remember. I don't.
Yeah.
It's the kind of case, I wasn't covering crime then, but I'm sure it was the talk of the people who covered crime.
Sure. Yeah.
Because there were so many elements to it that was intriguing. The fact that Andy was the son of a deputy and the idea of two people being shot by a sniper doing something any of us could have been doing. I mean, how many people go out to a park and hang out with a friend and sit on a log? And, you know, I was struck by it back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure the people who were covering it thought it was a case that needed to stay in the news.
It's really easy to forget what life was like before cell phones and before the internet. And maybe that may even be like hard to understand for some of our younger people who came up with all this technology. So have you noticed a change? Do you feel like there's been a big change over your career in how reporting is done?
I think there is a huge change in how reporting is reported, in that back in 93, 94, it would have been the journalist's job to just interview people, collect information, write the story. Today, that same journalist is probably taking the pictures, putting updates on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, maybe taking some live video. There are so many more responsibilities that they have than just solely focusing on the interview.
Do you feel like accountability is different now?
I don't. I mean, back in the 90s, journalists, I felt, really took their job seriously. And one of the things that we were instructed, even back in the 90s, and I believe it's even true today at the Beacon, is that if you make an error, you have to go and speak to the editor about it as quickly as possible. And then it gets published. And who made the error, the position of that person, gets put in the error. So there's, it's not to shame you. I mean, we're all human. We all make mistakes. Mm-hmm. But the point is, we are creating a historical record. And we want to really be proud of our transparency and our need to get it right and correct it when it's not. And I have never had problems with errors in my stories being reported. And I've had people write letters to the editor upset about something we've done. And a lot of times the editorial board would come and say, do you want to respond to them? And I would say, no, they have a right. Let them have their say without somebody pushing back and saying, absolutely. But this.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you know, we buy ink by the barrel. We get to say whatever we want, you know, and we hope we're doing the right thing. Let's give them a little bit of that ink. So I never replied in paper. You know, sometimes somebody would write a letter to the editor and it would say, you know, here's a response. And I'd say, don't respond. Let them have their say and don't act like you need to make an excuse.
I kind of feel like accountability is probably more and less enforced now at the same time because of social media. It's like there's immediate accountability, but also people are a lot quicker to print things that they don't necessarily verify thoroughly. And I don't know if that's accurate or not. But that's kind of how it seems sometimes.
But it's kind of runs into one of my next question was, what kind of fact-checking resources were available back before the internet when you guys rushed out there with like pens and papers?
Yeah.
Because now I feel like when you take a story, you take an interview, you can check that fact real quick.
Yeah. Right.
On your phone or on the internet before the update, first update is posted to Twitter, you can check that fact. What kind of resources did you have before that immediate access to information was available?
First of all, Liz is absolutely right. It is very easy and very tempting to post something on social media before you finish your report. And there is great opportunity for error there. One of the things that is helpful on the print end is if you say something in social media and somebody points out that error, you have the opportunity to correct it before it gets to print and in the archives of the newspaper. Yeah. So in that sense, the world becomes your fact checker and they have the opportunity to speak up before it gets to print. And it's print where it becomes a historical record.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's what goes into, you know, that's what people are going to be looking up 100 years from now. It's not going to be your social media account. So there's a very good thing about that.
Yeah.
As long as you're not embarrassed about it and you're very quick to say, you're right, this was an error, I'm going to fix it and not be ashamed, you know, of that process. Back in the 90s, the fact-checking was... You know what? There was a lot more fact-checking in the 90s, a lot more. There was a full copy editing staff. There were levels of editors that would look at your work. So you would do your story, send it to an editor. They would look it over. It would get sent probably to another editor. Mm-hmm. They would look it over. It would get sent to the copy desk. The copy desk had the luxury back then of checking name spellings, city locations, ages, but then also question things that they might think was stated in a slanted way, or even just, I'm not sure that's true. I think in another story, we said this about this fact, and then have the time to go back, look for it, and then communicate with the reporter and fix it. There was a lot of that fact checking. I will say today, that's gone. Most places don't have copy editors. The copy editing that's done now is to add a headline, although in a lot of places, the journalists are now writing their own headlines. Mm-hmm. The copy editor might be simply trimming the story to fit the space that it has been assigned to, mm-hmm. you know, in the print edition. But they don't have the luxury. They don't have the number of copy editors or the time to go in and fact check. So it really is up to the reporter to get it right. It really is.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that deadlines have been moved up?
There right now, I know at the Akron Beacon Journal, there are deadlines that are hitting like around 6 o'clock or earlier because the newspaper is not being printed at this plan anymore. It used to be you could change a story at midnight because you just yell down and tell the guys at the plant,
yeah.
hold up, we're changing something. Now it's printed in another city. They have their own papers to print. They're going to give you the worst deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
And there are deadlines at the Beacon. I happen to know that are before 6 p.m. So you got to get your story in. And if something changes at 7 or 8 p.m., it's too late.
Not going to make print.
Yeah.
Can you think of a time where an error did make it to print that ended up being harmful?
I'm sure there have been many over the years. Yeah. I'm trying to narrow down an example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure they have been times in the history of the newspaper where somebody was reported dead when they weren't.
What kind of an impact did that have on the person?
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's horrible. I remember once back in the 90s, there was a case where it didn't get into print, but it almost did, because there was a case where somebody had been killed and there was a person with an identical name in the same city. And we had a reporter calling the family of the person that wasn't dead to try to ascertain what had happened and very quickly realized they had the wrong person. So even in the reporting, if it doesn't make it into the paper, mm-hmm. you could still unwittingly cause hardship in a family, before it even gets to print. And I remember in that case, it was like, we have the wrong person, but it was crazy. It was the kind of thing where you wonder what you could have done differently.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was, we'll not call them at all,
yeah.
but how do you do journalism without calling people? You know, it's...
Yeah, you've got to make the phone call.
Journalists are human beings.
Right.
They're absolutely human beings. And they can have the best of intentions and the best of training. But when your job is 8 hours today, 8 hours a day to do this, you're going to make mistakes. It's like your entire professional life is doing this and you're not going to be 100%. So they can add up.
What's a newspaper's typical response to an error? Like, is there usually a retraction section? Is it usually like another headline, or does that depend on the severity of the story?
There is rarely a headline. Mm-hmm. Usually the readers of a newspaper will know a very specific area in the paper where the retractions are printed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been criticism from that. A mm-hmm. lot of people say, well, if you make a mistake, you should put it in the same place where you made the error. But for one reason or another, that has just not been the practice in the industry. So it's like we have a little box, and the Beacon Journal was called Getting It Straight.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, if you were a reader of the paper, you knew that you could look there each day. Now, obviously, if we do something that was in error and it changed the story because the error was so big, I've seen stories in the Beacon saying, we have to rewrite the story because it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that has happened. And boy, you just can't be shy about doing that. You have to do it. You just got to say you're sorry and do it. Because
I feel like that's a very, it takes a lot of humility to be able to do that. And I think a lot of people don't have that.
It's just honesty.
Yeah.
It's hard. I mean, nobody wants to make mistakes at work, especially mistakes that affect somebody else or make somebody else feel bad. Or I love history and I do a lot of research in historical archives. And I know, you know, even just doing the Ohio Mysteries podcast, I'll read these stories and I'll be like, I know that's not true, you know, but anybody who reads that, if they're not going to be careful about what they're just going to accept it as fact. And so I know that anything that I write goes into that same record, and 100 years from now, somebody's going to think that's fact. And I want it to be fact. So our stories in the digital archives, when you make a mistake, the mistake is added to the top of the story saying the story's preserved. But then it says, if you look down there, this guy's name is spelled this way, not this way. So there's a record up there that something in that story was wrong. We're trying to correct it.
Well, I've seen that before on online
stories. So on the digital, you know, system, that's great.
Yeah.
But if they're snapshots of the story, you're never going to see that.
Well, yeah, and we went through an awful lot of microfilm.
Yeah.
An awful lot. We didn't see any retractions like that.
Yeah. No, no, they're not on the microfilm.
No.
They're not on the microfilm.
And that goes to your point, though. It's like, no, this is actually a historical record. This is a verifiable fact.
You know? Yeah. And it's not. It's like anything else. If you are going to make a decision based on something you read, and I hope we're training a new generation to understand that, because they need this for social media. If you read something, do not accept it until you verify it yourself.
Right.
Find a way to verify everything. People used to get so annoyed at me because I would just go to their Facebook accounts and I would write false, here's Snopes, this was wrong. And, you know, they would just be like, you know, you're ruining it. The best way to ruin a good story is to check it out. You know?
Yeah. But never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's true of anything, even the best, you know, journalists, the best media. It's good to just use that as your guide. But if you're going to make decisions based on it, then check it out.
Yeah. So I want to add students, if there are any students, high school or college, please do not use Wikipedia as your main source. I just want to throw that out there.
Or if you see something in Wikipedia, take the next step. Exactly. Where did that source come from? Go to that source. Is that a source you can trust?
It's all on the bottom of Wikipedia. You know? You can actually follow it.
Footnotes.
Is it common practice for a reporter to look back to what's already been published to pull facts from for a new story?
Absolutely. I'll tell you, unless a fact has changed in a series of stories, that fact is probably just going to get transferred. So if I'm doing a story, and it's true with Ohio Mysteries, if I'm writing a story and it says Andy and Lisa were sitting on a log, I'm going to say Andy and Lisa were sitting on a log.
Right.
I have no other way of finding out, no, they were actually sitting in the sand or they were standing by a tree. I'm just going to take that for granted. The only way it will change is if I come across a story that suddenly says Andy and Lisa were, you know, leaning against a tree. And then I'm going to be like, oh, wait a minute. You know, maybe I better fudge this. Maybe I better say it was one or the other, or don't say it at all, because now I've got a fact in question. But, you know, if I'm interviewing you, you give me your name, you give me your age, I'm not going to go look up your birth certificate.
Right.
You tell me where you live, I'm not calling up your tax records.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm interviewing you and your neighbor's house was on fire and you say, I saw the flames coming out of the back of the house and John ran, you know, toward the front to go in and save them, I don't have a video to say whether, you know, I'm either going to believe you or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really hard to vet everything you hear. The only way I will really start questioning things from the historical record is if logic makes it silly, you know, it's like, that's crazy. Or if I see it repeated in a different way somewhere else. So yeah, facts will get just repeated. Unless there's cause to question.
Well, that makes sense. So if it's like a personal interview, if you're on the scene and you're talking to different people and you get different accounts from different people, is it completely normal to include both accountings?
Both or neither. If somebody says Johnny ran in through the front door to try to save them, and then somebody says, no, Johnny used the side door, then I might say Johnny ran into the house and forget the door.
Mm-hmm.
Or I might say, these people like were acting a little strange. I'm not going to use them at all. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's just a judgment call. I don't mm-hmm. know who these people are, but there's a valid, you know, they seem to be eyewitnesses, and you just make a judgment call. That's another thing. Cops are human too. Yeah. And sometimes they speak too soon before they've had the.
Well, and sometimes they don't give out information because they're trying to keep stuff back.
And that I understand. Not giving something's fine, but giving wrong information. That happens all the time. I will tell you that there is no reporter I have ever known who is sitting at their desk and making up a fact out of the blue.
One of the next things that I wanted to get your opinion on is the whole, is like the sensational aspect of journalism. I feel like that's kind of changed today, or kind of like a hybridization of actual factual reporting combined with like editorials, combined with features, combined with opinion, all under the guise of like news. Back when I studied journalism, it was, there was news, there were features, there were opinions, and like,
right, because she actually studies things.
I did actually study journalism.
Yeah, I did not.
You know, it probably really comes from the company that you're working for. I noticed that Fox News in particular, there's a lot of editorializing with the news. You know, I see a lot of broadcasters saying, you know, so-and-so was arrested for molesting a girl. And then they'll turn to the other anchor and say, can you believe that? Isn't that awful? And that kind of thing happens all the time.
Yeah.
And that used to be a huge no-no. It was like, no, you're not, you're just giving us the fact. So I think there's still plenty of media where they try very hard mm-hmm. to have that wall. So it really just depends on what media you're paying attention to.
Do you think that it's ever appropriate, or when, I should say, when is it appropriate to kind of editorialize and sensationalize like an actual news story?
Don't think it's ever okay to sensationalize. I think there is a style of writing, like narrative, mm-hmm. where it might really touch you emotionally. When the plane crashed in Ellet and killed those 9 people on board, mm-hmm. I was given the assignment to do a story, a narrative story about the event, the crash and who was on it. And so the story put you in the place of my lead, for instance, was mm-hmm. one of the women who died. And I have her walking down from her hotel room and having breakfast and eating these waffles mm-hmm. and how she's got a daughter at home and she can't wait to get back to her daughter. Now, I know she ate waffles because she posted the picture of it on Facebook. I know she's missing her daughter because she had a billion pictures of her daughter. And whenever she traveled, she would say, I miss you. So they are facts that I felt comfortable about mm-hmm. saying.
Yeah.
I felt that I could back them up. Mm-hmm. But I was certainly reaching out to you emotionally. I wasn't just saying this woman had breakfast and got on a plane and was killed. I'm trying to get you to experience what she experienced, her day. Mm-hmm. Experience her
day. I feel like you did some of that in episode 25. That's our episode, the Berlin Reservoir episode with Andy and Lisa in particular. Like, you really set a scene.
Yeah.
But it's all stuff that is verifiable.
Right. I think even in that scene, when I was done, I said, the police then sent out the forensics, and this is the scene that they set. So that you realize, nobody was there with them.
Yeah.
So you might be wondering why I'm saying these things, but I want you to know that this has been pieced together and seems to be likely. So is that sensational to kind of play on your emotions a little bit? You know, I don't think it is. I mm-hmm. think it's a different way of storytelling. I really want you to care about mm-hmm. this topic, and I want you to care about these people. Mm-hmm. So it's more than just presenting facts. It's really telling a story. Mm-hmm. So I like that kind of storytelling, but you do have to be careful with it because, mm-hmm. you know,
you don't want to embellish stuff that doesn't exist.
It's sometimes you can draw a little bit of a line. One thing you can do is sometimes there's a word or two you can put into the sentence that you want to say that explains that. You could say, it wouldn't be unreasonable to think that they were talking about what their week was like, you know? So mm-hmm. it's like you're inserting yourself and you're kind of clarifying that but the police do that too. Okay. You know, when they say, you know what, we think they were sitting there talking, you know, well, what makes you think they were sitting there talking? Well, they're the only two there, you know? Okay. So, but if you pull a little bit out of it, like, you know, was Lisa, you know, talking about her troubled life or something right. like that. You could say, we don't know what they were talking about, but there's a good chance Lisa might have been sharing some of the troubles in her life. And then you could talk about the troubles. And so you've set a scene where maybe she's confiding in Andy, but you've clarified that we don't know.
Did you get any information that Lisa may have had struggles with addiction?
No, not specifically. I know she had some medical issues that required her taking some medicine, mm-hmm. but it sounded like it was more psychiatric kind of drugs.
Okay. So what I'd like to get your opinion on is a photo that was printed in the Record Courier.
Brace yourself.
For you listening, we are not going to be posting this picture. It very much upset Lisa's family when it was published the first time, so we are not going to be publishing it, but I can tell you what the photo is.
This is the Record
about.
Courier. Okay.
Yes, and this went into print, and it is a photo of the crime scene in color.
So it's a little pixelated, but it looks like blood on
yes.
the beach.
Yes, and there should be the caption below it.
Blood spattered beachside, yeah.
My question is, what impact do you think the choice to run that photo in color?
I will tell you that this picture did not get in here by accident. I will tell you that the people who decided to put that picture in there mm-hmm. sat around a table. There were probably 10 people, and they probably discussed it for an hour mm-hmm. before they made a decision. I can't tell you why they decided, but I will tell you that they thought about it and they had a reason why they decided right. to go with it. I have been in a lot of meetings mm-hmm. where decisions were made like that. And there were a lot of times pictures were left out for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. I wish I could give you an answer. I don't know what their reason was. You know, maybe they thought showing that scene might cause somebody to remember something, or maybe showing that scene is their way of making sure the public really stands up and pays attention.
To make an impact?
It could be. Despite what a lot of people probably think, I don't think it was gratuitous. I don't think they did it because they thought it would sell newspapers. I really don't. I mean, I've been, especially in the 90s, I've been in a lot of those discussions. Journalists, the people who write the stories, we never had talks about making money for our company. Mm-hmm. We followed journalism because it was a calling, mm-hmm. and we might as well have been working for a nonprofit mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. we felt it was our job to serve the community. It was never, ever about making money. And as a matter of fact, if it would ever come up, that we even be the hint that something that we were doing was in some way impacting an economy somewhere, we would freak out. So I know it wasn't about selling newspapers. I don't know why they put that in. And I can see why it would upset some people. I think there's a good argument.
Yeah, I was just confused by the decision to run it in color, because back then, printing in color was a lot more expensive than printing black and white.
Were all of the front pages color?
No, that's not a front page. That's buried in the middle.
Okay. Back in the 90s, we had our front page of each section was in color. So if it was a picture that would show up on the front page, the fact that it was in color was just that page is going in color.
Yeah.
There's nothing we could do about that. But there was also a period where there was one or two inside pages mm-hmm. that were always color. Mm-hmm. And they were always color for the ads. And so if that turned out to be the throw page, mm-hmm. it could have been absolutely incidental.
I didn't see the rest of the page. So I was operating under the assumption that it was the choice to run that photo in color was intentional to, not necessarily to sell newspapers, but to create a bigger impact.
Boy, that is not the kind of journalism that I know people to practice.
Yeah.
I really think that that page was just printed in color and it just happened to throw to that page. But I have never been privy to a conversation mm-hmm. where somebody wanted to make a picture color to have a different impact.
The branch of journalism I studied was photojournalism, so we had a lot of those conversations.
Yeah.
And on microfilm, it's all in black and white, even if it was color.
Oh, mm-hmm. right. You know, there is no easy answer for families who go through something like this. I have had to go up and knock on the doors of families who have been through tragedy, and I have gotten two completely different responses.
Mm-hmm.
I have had people scream vulture and make you leave, and so you leave.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had people say, please come in. I really want you to know who my sister was.
Yeah.
and they mm-hmm. want to tell you. It's not just therapeutic, but it's like, my sister was a person. I'm not ashamed that she lived. I want her story out there. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the more you keep it out there, maybe the more likely something good is going to come from it. I've had both. And I understand the don't talk to me 100%, because frankly, I can't tell you which one I would be, even though I was a journalist. I mean, later, there's a third thing, and that is, don't talk to me right now. I'm stunned. But 2 weeks later, I'm calm enough now. I want to tell my loved one's story. And then they want you. A lot of times family will call us and invite us. There's no easy answer for, well, how one family reacts is not going to be the same as another family reacting. I will tell you, if that hurt the family and the people who did that knew how badly hurt the family was, they would feel it. Because they're human beings.
Right.
They're human beings who are very proud of what they're doing to inform their community. And they don't want to hurt any. So nobody wants to cause anybody pain like that. Sometimes.
Well, this all answers a lot of my questions about ethics and journalism in the 90s. So I really appreciate it.
Do you find it hard to stay objective in a situation like that? When you feel for the people who you're interviewing and you feel for the situation and your job is to report the facts? Like, do you find it hard to stay objective?
It is hard to stay objective going to a city council meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a human being and you are going to feel for every one of your stories. There at least used to be, before newspapers had to cut their staffs, there were a really good set of checks and balances. You know, mm-hmm. the copy editor who would come to you and say, I can tell by reading this article that you are a Republican. Go fix this.
Yeah.
You know, I can tell by reading this article that you're angry they can't raise chickens. Go fix this,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there would be people who would, and you'd be like, oh, I, you know, you're right. That word is a little tainted, you know,
mm-hmm. which is exactly why I don't work for a newspaper.
Yes, yes. But I will say journalists, especially veteran journalists, are trained to try to spot that themselves. And it's easy to think that reporters aren't putting that training into use, but we agonize over stuff like that. Whenever I would write a story, when the story's all done, right before I would send it, I would go through each paragraph and I would say, is that true? And I would do that for every paragraph, every single story I did, I would do that just to really remind myself, don't just assume that I was thinking straight, you know, make sure every fact in there, I had a reason for mm-hmm. it being there. Journalists do that. You know, they don't get credit for doing it, but they really do.
Do you feel like people still do that?
It's harder if your deadline is at 6 o'clock and you don't have a copy editor and a second editor that's following up. It's easier for stuff to slip through. I'm almost 60. I can talk about what journalism was like in my era. I really don't know what 24-year-olds coming out of journalism school, I don't know how much of that is emphasized with them.
Where do you think the public's right to know supersedes like a person's right to privacy?
You could ask that of any element of the story that you want to cover. And I don't know if there is a broad brush that would sweep all these facts into one part or another. I think there's no sensitive story that you can do that isn't going to negatively affect somebody. And if your rule of thumb is, we're not going to say it if it's going to upset somebody, then you have just said the opposite of the point of a newspaper. There was a quote, I forget who said it, but the job of the newspaper is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted.
I love it.
That is great.
So if it's going to hurt you that we're covering the death of a loved one, there's nothing that we can do to take away your pain. But we have a job to hold law enforcement's feet to the fire, to participate mm-hmm. in the process of getting information out there to the community who might be able to solve this crime. Maybe we owe it to your neighbors to know that next door house was a drug house, or maybe to let your neighbors know you might not want to go down Futon Road in the middle of the night. You may not want that information, you know, that story out there, but we have a greater calling to get that information out there. But there are a lot of minor things. The blood on the beach. I imagine there are a lot of newspapers that will have had that discussion and decided not to run that picture. And they would have said, you know what, it's not, the public doesn't need to see the blood on the beach to know what's going on in this case. And they would have made an argument not to run that. I don't want to be critical because I don't know what their argument was, but I promise you, That was not a one person thing. I'm telling you, there were 10 people in a room for an hour.
And from the sounds of things, there were literally a room full of people debating that at the time.
Absolutely.
Even if we don't have that now, that's what was going on then.
Absolutely.
I would have to think they would have talked about it long and hard, being who Andy was.
People, I hope people understand when they hear our podcast, we're not cops at all.
Right. Right.
That's not who we are. That's not what we're doing. We're literally just trying to find out what happened 25 years ago that nobody in Deerfield, Ohio will allow anyone to talk about. I had a family member tell me when I started this project, they were like, maybe you should just leave it alone. And I was livid because it's like, no, everybody leaving this alone is why it's unsolved 26 years later. I mean, that's what started our whole ball rolling.
That's a horrible answer to anybody. Let it go. Wow. No, somebody committed a crime, a horrific crime. There may have been three or more people in this case that committed horrific crimes. And saying you don't want to talk about it, you not only didn't allow justice for the people who died, that killer kept going free. So no, let it go is the absolute wrong answer.
I agree.
Before we go, though, is there anything you want to say about Lisa and Andy?
Or Kathy or Sarah?
Any of it.
I'm so glad you guys are keeping that story alive and in the public. One mystery I just did was out of the city of Columbus, and I found a story that mentioned that they have 800 solved murders. And I'm like, who do you pick to promote if you don't have somebody that is going to be the champion or the advocate of a case? Then they are just going to languish and never get solved. And on behalf of Lisa and Andy and Catherine and Sarah Ray, thank you for not only keeping them alive, but taking us through the process, because your detective work on this it's just really interesting to follow you as you're exploring it, and knowing that you guys kind of have something at stake, especially some of you who have lived in that area, and that's your home and that's your neighborhood. I think sometimes this is the most you can do. At the very least, just keep it out there and hope something will break free one day.
Thank you. So thank you so much for talking to us. We really appreciate it. Helped clear up some of our questions about reporting and how some minor details can get mixed up, and then it's reported in every paper afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
And it also helped us.
If you have any information, no matter how insignificant it may seem, about the deaths of Andy Hussey, Lisa Waters, Sarah Baim, or Catherine Menendez, please contact the Portage County Sheriff's Cold Case Information Line at 330-297-3890 or the FBI in Cleveland at 216-522-1400 or Pittsburgh at 412-432-4000. If you're not comfortable contacting law enforcement directly, you can reach out to us and we'll let them know anonymously if you wish. You can find us on Twitter at Murder Road Pod, and you can email us at murderroadpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram at Murder Road Podcast. Also, we play by Murder Squad rules here. Please, no naming names in public, no side-by-side photos. Don't dox each other and just be nice out there. I also would like to include a note that we will protect people's anonymity to the best of our ability every time. It's important.
So if you do reach out to us and you're afraid of being on air, having your name played on air, all you have to do is request that we don't, and we will honor your wishes.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, it's never too late to make a difference.
Music for this episode is provided by Penguin Music, Zapsplat.com, and Palmcat Studios.